And we're back on Baltimore Internet Radio. I'm Dave Custia, your host. I'm here with Neil Franklin, Executive Director of Leap. When we were off the air, we were talking a little bit about some cities that he's targeting.
There are a couple of things that we're looking at. Number one, we talked earlier about Washington and Colorado with marijuana. We know that, according to the federal government, that 60, maybe a little more than 60% of the profits from the illegal drug trade, the profits that are brought in by our criminal gangs and the cartel, it's roughly about 60%. Marijuana makes up about 60% of that, if not more. We want to continue, obviously, to move forward with marijuana and taking that profit away from organized crime. So Oregon State, we're looking at some states here in on the East Coast, up in New England, Rhode Island, Massachusetts, New Hampshire, and so on. We're looking at California. We're looking at Alaska. We're looking at a number of states in maybe, if not in 2014, 2016, to move legislation. And again, people, now that people are learning more and more about this policy and the failure of it and why we need to move in a different direction, they're starting to move this issue and this policy through referendum. Another interesting thing is our state politicians are beginning to move pieces of legislation. In Maryland, just this past spring, we had a number of state delegates sponsor a bill to legalize marijuana here in the state of Maryland. We had the same thing happen in Pennsylvania. Very few people saw this coming. So obviously, as the years go on, we're going to see more and more and more of this. Something that's very important for what I just mentioned is a bill, H.R. 1523 on Capitol Hill. That's H.R. 1523 for those of you that want to Google it. Basically, it is a bill that's being introduced to have the federal government change the Controlled Substances Act, to amend it, to allow states to decide what to do and how to manage marijuana, which would, in a sense, mean moving marijuana out of a Schedule I category, which would allow the states to decide what to do. If that happens, if we're able to get that passed, then you're going to see many states move forward with ending the prohibition of marijuana. On a national average, I think the most recent poll that I know of, 52% of Americans believe that we should legalize marijuana across the board. I think there's a new study being conducted now as we speak on your show, and I think we'll have results for that soon, and I know for a fact it's going to go up. Even beyond marijuana, you know, as we talk about other drugs, you know, because our organization believes that all drugs should be legalized, regulated, and controlled at some level. So heroin, I'd like to see something begin in Baltimore and Seattle, two cities that have a severe heroin, as I would put it, epidemic. And if we're able to do something similar to maybe what they've done over in Switzerland, I think that would be extremely beneficial. You know, my question is, how do we siphon those who are addicted to these drugs away from the corner drug deal? Number one, it's going to stabilize their life more, which makes their family environment better. By pulling them away from the neighborhood drug dealer, their profits begin to go away. And if their profits go away enough, you know what? They'll go away.
Right. They're also getting cleaner stuff.
Absolutely.
You never know what you're getting from the corner guy.
Yeah, not only cleaner stuff, but you'll know what the potency level is. That's one of the reasons we have so many overdose deaths, because when you're buying drugs from drug dealers on corners, you have no idea how potent your drug is. So, Dave, if you're buying heroin from me, you've been buying heroin from me to use for the past 3 months, I mix mine the same way all the time, so it's going to be, say, 20% pure. But then the police come lock me up. They've been working me for 6 months, right?
Mm-hmm.
So they come lock me and my crew up. Now you've got to go buy your heroin if you don't want to get sick from someone else. And when you do that, you're taking a huge risk. And that next person you're buying your heroin from might be mixing theirs at 35 or 40% pure. Mm-hmm. Next thing you know, you're having an overdose and you're going to die.
I go back to you because I know your prices are insane.
Well, I'll tell you one thing. If we moved into some form of regulation and control, prices would drop dramatically. Mm-hmm. There again, would help with the issue of, you know, the crime that's being committed by those who are addicted. you know, because the prices are so high, they have to steal and rob and do the things that they do to, you know, raise a couple hundred dollars a day to feed their app.
And it affects everybody negatively. Anybody that gets involved.
It really does. If you want to breathe life back into these communities, I mean, I think of my mother's community. If you're in Baltimore, you know Baltimore, you know Reservoir Hill. And that's where my mom still lives today. She's been there for over 50 years in that community. And we've seen that community go from a thriving community with a wonderful business district to being desolate. Mm-hmm. Vacant house after vacant house. All the businesses were torn down. They're now vacant lots, open-air drug markets on a number of different corners. And just last week, we had the homicide of one of the grandson of one of our neighbors. Mm-hmm. He just recently got out of federal prison for doing time, being involved with a heroin ring in that community. He did his time, decided he was going to do his best to walk straight. He got a job over in Essex. He had to leave every morning, you know, around 5:30 every morning to go to work. He would catch the bus just a half a block away from my mother's house. And last week he was shot dead on that bus stop. And it's no doubt in my mind that it's related to what he was doing before he went into prison and now that he's out. And, you know, once you're in that business, man, very seldom are you able to get out, even if you want to.
He was trying to improve himself.
Absolutely. So the violence in our community is still at an all-time high, and we can't breathe any life back into that community. We can't get businesses to come in and invest because of the violence.
Yeah. So filters down from another thing. I was thinking just the other day about having neighborhoods really embrace business, but with the drugs all around,
right?
That's the biggest business. So it's going to be tough to get that out and say, here, you know, start your own business. And, you know, if drug dealers come, well, gee, you know, what can you do?
Right.
Because it'd be great to have legitimate businesses in those areas, like the one you just described, Reservoir Hill, and have them have business with other people in the area and then expand all over. Mm-hmm. And like we're doing here, expand worldwide. Mm-hmm. You know, that's a possibility. And there are entrepreneurs in those areas.
There are.
But when you walk out your front door every day and you see what you see, I guess it's quite intimidating and just kind of takes away, you know, all the
Think about some
ambition.
Of the challenges of starting up a business. Say you open up a storefront in one of these communities, and you've got a number of things you got to deal with. Number one, you got to deal with the violence, as I was just talking about. You got to deal with drug dealers being out in front of your door like they were sitting on your stoop. Okay, you got to deal with those who are addicted stealing from you to sell, you know, to get money, you know, so they're boosting from your store to sell to get money so that they can buy what they need, you know, for their habits. So they'll rob you blind, literally, so you can't really survive. And no one wants to put forth that much effort when you can go somewhere else and open up shop or just go work for somebody else instead of opening up your own business. So, you know, those are just a few challenges that an entrepreneur would have trying to open up a business in the current environment of the drug war.
So I could be a devil's advocate right now. Are there any kind of organizations like yours that want to keep the same drug laws, that want to work within that system and try to do better? And where are they? Because I haven't heard about them.
Well, there's plenty of organizations that want to maintain the status quo for various reasons. First of all, it's no longer just big business for criminal gangs and organizations. It's now big business for everybody. It's big business for prisons. It's big business for treatment centers. It's big business for drug testing companies. Drug testing companies are raking in billions of dollars every year. It's big business for law enforcement. You know, there's plenty of overtime, asset forfeiture programs. So anyone we lock up for a drug crime, violent or not, we seize their assets. We take whatever cash they have on them. We take their property. We take their cars. We're taking cars from people here in Baltimore. If we stop a car and find a joint, marijuana cigarette in their car, we're seizing their car.
Jeez.
We're seizing any cash that they have on their person.
It seems like it's coming full circle, because I grew up in the 60s, and I can remember, you know, when drugs starting to get in to neighborhoods and such, and nobody knew really what to do and knew how to control it or even to, you know, legislate it, what have you. And I can remember one story where a guy had less than an ounce, and he got 25 years in prison.
Yeah.
And it seems like it's, you know, coming back to that. Is it coming back to that, or is your organization,
I think we're along with other organizations, are working on things such as mandatory minimum sentencing. We realize that many of the mandatory minimum sentencing policies we put in place in the 1980s, we're realizing now that that was such a bad way to go, a bad thing to do. And we're reversing a lot of that. But some of the organizations that are pushing against us, such as, Drug-Free America, I really applaud what they're trying to do. You know, they want less drugs available to our children. But it's an impossibility. Drug-Free America, I understand, but it's an impossibility. We agree with many organizations that, that still support prohibition. We agree that drugs can be a problem. Obviously, we agree that drugs are abused by people in this country. We agree that we want to do the best that we can to keep drugs out of the hands of our young people. We agree on all that stuff. Where we disagree is the policy that we need in place to make this happen. Okay? Prohibition has already proven itself that it's not the policy we need in place. We need one of regulation and control. We need one where we remove the control away from the criminals and we take responsibility for it. Drugs have always been used and available to people on this planet. We're not doing something that hasn't been done before. Drugs used to be legal in this country. Marijuana, cocaine, heroin. You could buy heroin at your local pharmacy for $4.85 an ounce. So, you know, it's the policies that we currently have in place are not really about drug abuse. That's not how they came about. They came about to control groups of people. The very first policy against opium in this country only affected the Chinese. It was illegal for the Chinese to possess opium, not anyone else. Because the Chinese, they had finished helping us build the railroad in this country, and they now started to take other jobs that were desired by white males in this country, and they had to do something to limit that. Right. And so that's what they did. So we really have to go back and look at why we have these policies in place, in the, you know, to begin with. And, you know, on that premise alone, I think the average person would say, well, then we need to end what we're doing, and we need to come up with a new set of policies for managing drugs in our neighborhoods, in our communities.
And speaking to that, you talked about changes locally, state. Mm-hmm. Oh. What about the government itself? You have factions of Democrats and even Republicans that are leaning towards you?
And that's changing every day. We actually have policymakers, representatives who are actually winning office. They're beating incumbents during the election process on a platform of drug policy reform. Beto O'Rourke is one example of a congressman in El Paso, Texas, who beat out the incumbent during the last major election. And, you know, his platform was end the drug war, end the prohibition of drugs. We have another congressman from Colorado. We have many of our state representatives here, like Kurt Anderson, you know, here in Baltimore, who's trying to do the same thing. And there are many more. And I've talked to many. off the record, they will tell me, you know what, you're right. I mean, yeah, this policy doesn't work. It never did work. It's very problematic. It's very costly. It's very dangerous. Yeah, but I'm not comfortable yet. And that's the main thing. They're not comfortable yet in coming forward saying that this is what they're about. Now, as the polls continue to shift, you know, then you'll start seeing more of them come forward and embracing this. But the vast majority of our policymakers that have the knowledge about the failure of this policy, they already know.
Yeah.
You know, it's just a matter of timing for them, because I was once told that, you know, when it comes to being a politician, there are only two things that are important to you. The first one is getting elected. And then the second thing is staying up, getting reelected.
That's very true. It seems that
those are the two most important.
Once they get in the office, they spend most of their time doing the latter.
Right.
Back to LEAP. Can you outline your short-term and long-term goals?
Yeah. Short-term is basically to do the busy work of educating the average citizen about the facts, about the failure, and about the need to move forward with new policy. And we do that very effectively in our group settings and when our speakers go out and do their work. Also short-term, to do the same thing with our policymakers. Long-term, it is basically to bring more and more of folks from the law enforcement professional into our fold, into our ranks. We know that if we are successful at getting more of our comrades to step forward, that we will end this thing very soon. We had no idea just 4 years ago that we'd be where we are today with marijuana reform. And so we know that if we keep doing what we're doing day in, day out, we do that daily grind that we've been doing of speaking engagements and meetings and radio shows like yours, Dave, that it won't be long before we hit the tipping point and this country just moves forward. Another long-term piece is really on the international scale, is to get the United Nations to change their treaty on narcotic drugs. That's one of the things that the federal government continues to tout, is that, well, you know, this is a United Nations issue as well because of that treaty. And they're saying that there's some things that they can't do, but that's not true. The United States can move forward with reform.
Now, what about do you have any kind of business plan for, I know it's not up to you, but do you have anybody that's been thinking about, if this comes to fruition, all this money that they save, is that the politicians, or is there anybody in your organization that you know, work in that field or anything, that just say, this is what we could save, this is what we could do with it? I know you've got areas where say, this is how much we can save, but do you go into any detail?
Yeah, that's an extremely good question, because it's so broad too, but a couple of key points regarding the financial end. Because first of all, you're going to be looking at a savings from the enforcement end. You know, $50 billion a year roughly is going to be saved. You know, so what do you do with that money? Well, obviously a portion of it needs to go to treatment and education and hit it from the front end of, from a medical perspective, as far as drug abuse in this country. We started to touch on something else earlier, too, as far as the money being brought in a particular community. You know, the money that's being generated within a community from illegal drug sales, and that money continues to circulate within that community. It's spent in stores, it's spent paying heating bills, paying rent. There's an economy there, kind of like a sub-economy there. You know, in Baltimore, Walmart is not the number one single employer in Baltimore, it's the drug trade.
Really?
The drug trade employs more people in Baltimore and many other cities than any other single business. You know, so what happens when we end that flow of money, you know, within that drug dealing community, within that community, period? It has to be replaced. We're going to have to work on the infrastructure. We're going to have to come in with jobs and job training and job placement. We're going to have to, you know, do something with our educational program. You know, we're going to have to replace that economy with something that's legal and something that's viable. So that's something that we need to think about.
We never, you have to have the ground, hit the ground running
with
that too as soon as it happens.
Something else that we miss is that we never have really done a good study on the indirect cost of the drug war. You know, I just gave you some direct cost figures for enforcement. But what about the indirect cost? There's an attorney by the name of Eric Sterling, who is the president of the Criminal Justice Policy Foundation in Silver Spring, Maryland. And Eric Sterling has done some work on what it's costing the business community, what the drug war is costing the business community. A quick example of what he means by that is, look at the number of people we've put in prison. We've gone from under a half a million people in prison at the beginning of the drug war to now 2.3 million people in prison. Jeez. Now, not just the people who are in prison, but when they come out, no one hires them because of the stigma of having a conviction. What does that do to the average business? Well, if someone's not employed, obviously, they can't patronize your store. If someone's in prison, they're not buying cars from your car dealership. If someone's in prison, they're not buying new homes. If they're in prison, they're not shopping your business, which causes your business to grow, and then you can hire more people. So we're doing ourselves a disservice with the number of people that we continue to send to prison. So that's just a small example, but when someone's in prison, it's costing us anywhere from $35,000 to $50,000 a year to house them.
Right.
Now, they're not paying taxes. So if they were out of prison, gainfully employed, they would be paying taxes. Again, they would be shopping at local stores and whatever, contributing to society. So it's not just the $35,000 or $50,000 we're losing of our tax dollars. We're also missing out money on the positive side of that equation of them paying into the economy if they were actually out and employed.
And plus,
so
it's
a double hit.
Too.
Right, it's a double hit.
Yeah.
What about the people who are addicted and they end up in the emergency room day in and day out? What is that emergency room visit costing us? You know, what is it costing us in other services, social service programs that are needed for the families whose father we just sent to prison or mother we just sent to prison? You know, many of the people who sell drugs or who are addicted to drugs do have jobs. And,
right.
and so we put them in prison, and now what's left of the family unit, there's no money coming into the household, and now our tax dollars have to take care of that family for who knows how long. And so those are just a couple examples of many as to the indirect cost of this drug war. You know, what it costs, the number of shooting victims that we have in this country. I know, you know, we have school shooting after school shooting after school shooting. And there's so much attention given to that. Now, don't get me wrong. You know, I feel for those people. I think it's a tragedy. And you know, I'm not going to get into gun control and the details of gun control. But by far, the vast number of children murdered in this country don't come from school shootings like that. Mm-hmm. The vast number of people in this country don't come from movie shootings like in Aurora, Colorado. It's on our street corners. It's in our cities and in our neighborhoods. As we sit here and talk right now, someone's being shot. Multiple people are being shot and killed. What is that costing us when they go to shock trauma in a hospital? you know, not just the ones that die, but what about the ones that are just wounded and they end up in the emergency room?
That's a very good point. Maybe on your website you should create like a graph or a bubble and saying drug dealers, and this is what, like a tree of what the effect, because, and then have a monetary value toward it, like that, because it makes a lot of sense, but it really is, do you have that visual, I think,
right.
You know, for people to see that, and it's, people are hearing this now.
You know, there is one thing I have to mention. I talked a little bit about my career, but I didn't talk about, you know, what really prompted me to take a good look at what was happening with our drug policies. When I left the Maryland State Police, when I retired, that very year I retired, a good friend of mine by the name of Ed Totley was working undercover with the Maryland State Police. He was assigned to a task force down in Washington, D.C. with the FBI, and he was buying cocaine from a mid-level drug dealer in Tacoma Park. And we had talked about this case, he and I, and on October 30th of 2000, he was going to make the final buy of cocaine from this guy. And this night, the guy decided he was going to rip Ed Totley off for both the money and the drugs. And unfortunately, he decided that he would have to kill Ed Totley in order to do that. And he shot him at point-blank range in the side of the head.
Oh, my God.
So here's a family, Ed's family, mother, father, his mother and father, who lost a son. His wife lost a husband. And his kids. His three kids lost the father. And I started thinking about other cops that I knew. When I was working undercover here in Baltimore, Marcellus Ward, a detective for Baltimore City, was killed in a similar circumstance in an apartment here in Baltimore City, making a drug buy while working undercover. Michael Cowdery was killed not too far from here on Harford Road, confronting a drug dealer on a corner. And others, and then it was 2 years after that, there was the Dawson family right up here on Preston Street, family of seven, whose home was set on fire one night by a drug dealer who was pissed off because the mother was working with the police to get him off of the corner, arrested and out of their neighborhood. He set their home on fire and killed the entire family. All she was trying to do was protect her young boys from being recruited into that business. And this happens across this country. Day in and day out.
You never hear about it.
And we never hear about it. The numbers...
It's horrible because it's come so commonplace.
Right. If we ended the drug war, if we ended these drug policies, you know how many fewer murders we'll have in this country every year? I mean, I have no doubt that we would at least cut the homicide rate by guns in half in this country. I think one of the main problems is that the people that have the power to do it haven't been affected.
Yeah, that's the shame about so many things that are tragedies and all. People turn around and actually start, you know, being active with something if it happens to them directly. And it shouldn't be the case. And you know, hopefully it doesn't happen to a lot of people that are really going to do something about this.
Yeah, I wish we could, you know, affect this change. We know it's needed. The president knows, but, you know, he's got to play the political, he's got to do the political posturing and what have you, but he knows. I know he knows because he came from Chicago. Chicago is off the hook with drug prohibition, violent crime. Literally off the chain. You know, and he knows that. So he knows about Central America. He knows about Mexico and the tens of thousands of people who have been murdered by the cartel over the past few years in Mexico and all on down through Central America. He knows that. This is his last term. I just wish that he would have the courage to step forward, take a bold stance and say, you know what? I'm convening a blue ribbon panel, and we're going to dissect this drug war, and we're going to come up with a new policy that works. Reduces death, disease, crime, and addiction. That's going to be the focus.
You would think it would be an amazing legacy for him.
It would be a wonderful legacy for him.
So in closing, we could go right into this. This is perfect transition. You guys are basically a grassroots organization, and you just talked about the higher-ups that have their hand tied, mostly politically and such. So the people are the ones that can make this change.
Absolutely.
People are the ones that can say, I'm going to contact LEAP, and I'm going to see what I can do myself in my own community, in my own little piece of the world. And so, in ending, why don't you give out some contact info?
Yeah, let me begin again with our website, which is www.leap.cc. And you can go to our website and you can reach me, you can reach any one of our speakers, you can request any one of our speakers, you can watch our wonderful videos that we have, you can learn the talking points on how to speak to regarding this issue to your friends and your family. And I encourage each and every one of you out there listening to just educate yourselves. You know, not just our website, but we have links to other wonderful websites. A great read for you, which you can access from our website, is Drug War Facts. And just like I know this, if you got a young listening audience, they may not get this, but I believe his name was from the show Dragnet.
Oh, yeah.
Just the Facts.
Just the Facts, man. I was just thinking about that the other day, yeah. Was it Joe Gannon or something like that?
Yeah,
Joe Friday. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
Well, it's especially keenly felt because you have a main operation here, for lack of a better word, I can't think of right now, here in Baltimore. So I would like to keep an ongoing relationship with LEAP and have you guys back many times as you'd like. And it's a great inaugural show here at Baltimore Internet Radio. I'm Dave Custy, and keep tuned in for our other programs. I'd like to thank Neil Franklin, the Executive Director of LEAP, Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. And like Neil just said, you can contact him through the website. Thanks for listening, and of course the show gets repeated. It's recorded, but it's going to be repeated, and we're going to have plenty more shows. Thank you, Neil. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Dave.